The Israel of the Alps. Chapter 15. More Martyrs. AD 1535 to AD 1635. As from each sheaf of a great harvest the grain used to be taken to make up the heap which was intended for the altar, so from each epoch we select a memorial, from each persecution a precious gem of courage and piety, destined to a place in the group of Vaudois martyrs, the offering of their churches on the altars of the true God. That there may be no blank in this sketch, which is intended to refer to all the events of the history in connection with all the martyrdoms, let us first direct our thoughts to the circumstances which occasioned them. At the period of the Reformation, the Christians of Provence and of the valleys made common cause with the Reformers. The attention of the Church of Rome was fatally drawn to them in the first instance in Provence, at the gates of Avignon. This Rome of the West could not be expected to do otherwise than contend against the religious awakening which menaced its predominance. The Inquisitor, John de Roma, raised the first piles upon the slopes of Lebrun. The proceedings against these victims led to the discovery, amongst the heretics of Provence, of many persons from the valleys of Piedmont. The court of Aix wrote concerning this to the Senate of Turin, and the Senate named a commissioner, Pantaleon Bersauer, to go to the places mentioned and take information. Bersauer returned from Provence with numerous particulars of precise information concerning the principal families of the Vaudois of Piedmont, and concerning the high antiquity and the extent of the ministry of the Barbus, which they carried on in silence, that it might bear the more fruit, and of which the distant ramifications were not suspected, even in the very places where they existed. Like those marine plants which make their appearance on the surface of the waters only by a few green and almost unnoticed summits, but which pass through all the depths of the ocean to fix their roots in the primitive soil, the Vaudois, maintaining always their relation to the primitive church, had passed through centuries, and surmounted the increasing tide of superstition. Possessing no worldly eminence or personal distinction, they were not inapt to be confounded, by an indifferent observer, with the immense mass which surrounded them, and to this lowliness they owed their greatness. Their extension was carried on more successfully in the shade than it could have been in the blaze of day. They avoided the storm which might have broken on their heads. But so soon as attention and inquiry were directed to them, a discovery was made of the whole extent which their association, seemingly of so little importance, had secretly attained. Bersauer, furnished with the informations which he had received in Provence, repaired to the valleys, and continued the inquisitorial proceedings commenced by the court of Aix. Many witnesses were then brought to give evidence concerning this evangelical religion. One of them, Bernardine Fia of Saint-Sigant, being interrogated by the judge who presided in the investigation concerning the intercourse which he had had with the heretics, replied in this manners, "Being at Bricaras in 1529, I met Louis Turin of St. John, who took me into his house on business. Our business being ended, another inhabitant of St. John, named Catalan Girardet, came to see us, and invited us to accompany him as far as La Tour, where he said we would hear things that were good. Louis Turin himself pressed me to accept the invitation, and we set out. When we had arrived at La Tour, Catalan conducted us behind the house of Chabert Huguet. This was probably a descendant of the person who, in 1310, purchased from one of the last dauphins of the Viennois a house in Val-Louise, that it might be used for the religious meetings of the Vaudois. We entered into a great apartment, where many persons were assembled. There a barber, named Philip, preached, and after his duties were over, he asked me some questions, and instructed me in certain points of their religion. What did he say to you? That there is no salvation but in Jesus Christ, and that we ought to do good works, not in order to be saved, but because we are saved. However, as this witness had not ceased to attend Mass, he was not disturbed, but a prosecution was commenced against Catalan Girardet, who had drawn him to that meeting. Compelled to quit the valleys, Catalan was arrested at Revel, about the end of the year 1535, in course of which the evidence of Bernardine Fia had been given against him. He did not for an instant attempt to disguise his opinions, and being strongly urged to abjure them, he replied to the monks who came into his dungeon to tempt him to apostasy, "You will sooner persuade these walls to go on pilgrimage than a Christian to deny the truth." The fear of death had no greater effect in shaking his constancy. He was condemned to be burned alive. On the way to the stake, the monks who attended him still tried to persuade him to abjure. "Why should you be obstinate in your heresy?" said they. "Your rude and barbarous sect will soon be, like your own flesh, consumed in a moment. taking up two stones from the road, and rubbing them one against another, Catalan Girardet exclaimed in reply, "It would be easier for me to rub these stones to powder than for you to destroy our churches." This assurance of the martyr was not mistaken. He died firm and serene, his countenance radiant, even as seen through the flames which devoured him, with the blessed certainty of that salvation which he had received, and of that eternal happiness which he was going to receive. But is death endured for a profession of religion the only martyrdom? And has the Christian, visited with it for Christian works, no right to be also held in pious remembrance? A short time after the Count of La Trinity had laid waste the Vaudois valleys by fire and sword, the pastor of Prahl, named Martin, received a visit from two men who had been in the service of the seigneurs of Le Perrier, the cruel and perfidious Truchets, those relentless enemies of the Vaudois, who had already dragged to martyrdom Bartholomew Hector, the seller of Bibles. The pastor of Prahl was a native of France. The two strangers called themselves Frenchmen. Martin received them as fellow countrymen. They then expressed a desire to enter the Reformed Church, and the good pastor continued to entertain them as his guests, whilst he sought to instruct them in the way of salvation. His parishioners, however, warned him to be upon his guard, for there is in the common people an instinctive sagacity, which sometimes gives a presentiment of danger with an accuracy of judgment, independent of evidence. Moreover, as these intruders had recently carried arms against the Vaudois, it was natural enough that they should regard them with distrust. Nevertheless, the simple good pastor believed in the sincerity of their conversion, and appealed on their behalf to the charity of his flock against the insinuations which were made respecting them. His benevolent representations did not reassure the people of Prahl, who saw, with so much the more displeasure, these ill-reputed strangers dwelling under the roof of their pastor, that the latter had no family and lived by himself. But the worthy man, considering them almost as his adopted children, continued to treat them with the most generous hospitality. One morning, however, he did not appear at church at the ordinary hour of public worship. The people gathered anxiously around his dwelling. The door was bolted. They knocked. No one answered. Some neighbors then mounted upon the roof, and penetrated into the interior by a skylight, and presently their cries of grief announced to those without some bloody catastrophe. In fact, the pastor Martin was lying lifeless, and bathed in his blood. The monsters, whom he had received with kindness, had cut his throat at and taken flight, after having plundered the house of their benefactor. The Vaudois pursued after the culprits, but in vain. No trace of them could be discovered. But some time after they boldly reappeared in the valley, being again in the service of the seigneurs of Le Perrier, who thus made themselves their accomplices, and who, perhaps, had been the instigators of this odious assassination. No doubt there was imprudence on the part of the pastor, in the too generous reception which he gave to these cutthroats. But ought not he also to be reckoned a martyr, who died confessing the gospel by the works of a charity carried the length of self-sacrifice, as much as if that self-sacrifice had been made by a profession of religion? In consequence of the persecutions of which this execrable crime was one of the last fruits, the Elector Palatine sent an embassy to the Duke of Savoy, to intercede with him on behalf of the Vaudois. They were at that time ill-used, in a multitude of ways, by the Counselor Barberi, whom Emmanuel Philibert had appointed his commissioner to treat with them. The secretary of the Palatine's legation was a Protestant pastor. Barberi, thinking he might do what he pleased, caused him to be arrested by his minions at the very hotel of the ambassador. And without any other cause or pretext than simply that of his religion, he had the audacity to put him in prison. This fact, of itself, may give an idea of the fierceness which then characterized the proceedings against the Protestants, and by this we may understand how much the Vaudois must have displayed of prudence, of irreprehensible probity, of patient endurance, and of active virtues, to avoid giving any occasion to their adversaries, whereby these proceedings might appear anything else than barbarous cruelties and flagrant acts of injustice. This secretary of legation, who himself was very soon released, wrote them an affecting letter on this subject, of which the commencement is as follows. "Dear brethren, in the work of the Lord, all things work together for good to them that love God, and the violence to which I have been subjected will give occasion of reflection to His Highness, who will from this time, I trust, show himself less prejudiced against you. If it should prove, however, that instead of becoming more mild, and moderating the severity at present exercised, the Duke becomes more embittered. Be assured that it will be a plain token that God is about to interpose. But I trust that God will have pity on His Highness, and hear the prayers, cries, and tears of those who groan under the burden of this horrible persecution, to turn the heart of their prince, and to inspire him with compassion for his people. As to the answers which the Chancellor Stropiano has made to our intercession for you, he accuses you of being disturbers of the public peace. Such is the exact expression, so that it will be seen not to be of recent invention. He pretends that the Vaudois conspire against the state, and in support of that accusation, he quotes the case of 9 religionaries who recently assembled in a frontier town, at Bourg-en-Bresse, for that province was then a part of Savoy, and whom he has caused to be imprisoned as conspirators. We shall now examine into some particulars of these pretended conspiracies. A few Christians had met in a private house to meditate together on the Word of God. After this exercise they prayed for the triumph of the gospel, when the officers of justice, guided by a pious, that is, a Catholic information, arrived upon the spot, surrounded the place of meeting, and seized all who were present. As the captives protested against this violation of a private abode, and as no cause of complaint could be found against them, they were accused of an imaginary conspiracy. Now, the men could not prove that they had not conspired, and so they were condemned to the galleys, as persons suspected of having conspired. "There is nothing new under the sun," says Solomon, and the same parodies on a court and on justice were repeated in 1793, against other doctrines, and in name of another fanaticism. The Vaudois of Dauphiny and of Provence also paid, at this time, their tribute of martyrs to maintain the constant testimony of the Christian Church against the constant assaults of Antichrist. The Valley of the Grave, which descends from Le Pelvoux in a direction opposite to that of the Val Louise, had, in former times, been enlightened by some straggling rays of that evangelical light, whose center of radiance was in the midst of the Vaudois valleys. A mercer of Villers-d'Yarens, one of the most secluded villages of this valley, after having conducted his family, why to Geneva, that they might there be educated, and taught to walk in the ways of the Lord, was himself brought back to France by the necessity of attending to his business. Being particularly skillful as a worker of coral, Romeo repaired to Marseilles in order to buy corals, and on the way he endeavored to dispose of the goods which he carried with him. Passing by Draguignan, he showed them to a goldsmith of that town, named Lantome, who thought them very beautiful, and would have bought them, but the artist and he not being able to agree about the price, they parted without concluding a bargain. The Baron de Lauris was then at Draguignan, the son-in-law of Mynheer d'Apide, whose name is written in letters of blood in the history of the Vaudois. Lantome, unwilling to allow the treasures which he had seen on the previous evening to pass out of his hands, advised Romeo to exhibit them to a wealthy seigneur, who would probably purchase them, and named to him the Baron of Lauris. When the covetousness of the Baron had been awakened by the sight of so good a prey, Lantome went and informed him that Romeo was a Lutheran. Confiscation of goods followed, of course, upon a sentence of death. The two participators in this meditated spoliation understood one another precisely. Romeo was apprehended, at command of Lauris, by the vigor of Draguignan, in April, 1558. After he had undergone several examinations, in which he made a frank confession of his faith, the court of Draguignan met for his trial. An Observantine monk, who preached in that town during Lent, said, "I shall sing a mass to the Holy Spirit, that he may suggest to the judges to condemn that cursed Lutheran to death." But his mass did not produce all the effect which he expected from it, for a young advocate having risen at the bar of the court, pointed out that Romeo had not been guilty of any offense, that he had neither preached nor taught his doctrine in France, that he was a foreigner, and did nothing in Provence but attend to his trade, and that therefore justice ought to protect him and not to condemn him. All the bar supported this doctrine. The votes of the court were divided, one half for acquittal, and one half for condemnation. And of what sort of magistrates was this court composed? The following fact will show. One of them, named Barbizi, having heard the firmness spoken of, which Romeo had shown in his examinations, came to see him in his prison. He was, as Crespin tells us, an illiterate, fat, ill-formed man, with a flat large nose, a hideous aspect, a sluggish disposition, and addicted to gluttony and lasciviousness. On his entrance, he coarsely addressed the prisoner. "What place do you belong to?" What are you? What do you believe in? I am a native of Dauphiny, was the reply. I dwell in Geneva. I trade in coral. I believe in God and in Christ my Savior. Do the people of Geneva believe in God? Do they pray to him? Do they serve him? Said the judge. Better than you, was the quick reply of the poor captive, whose feelings were wounded by such suspicions and language. Accordingly, Judge Barbizi voted for his condemnation, but in consequence of the equal division of votes, the condemnation could not be pronounced. The observantine monk, who made this, so to speak, his personal affair, and who already saw the credit of his prayers and his masses singularly compromised in public opinion by the uncertainty of the court, caused the bells to be violently rung, got the populace to run together, and exclaimed that good Catholics ought not to suffer an infamous heretic, a Lutheran, a man already damned, to come and defile with impunity by his presence the devout town of Draguignan. He then went with his passionate advices to the official and the consuls of the town, representing to them that it concerned their honor to maintain intact the excellent reputation of their beloved city, and altogether, supported by the ragged populace and a raging rabble of priests, proceeded to the doors of the magistrates, exclaiming that if they did not condemn the heretic to be burned, they would themselves be denounced to the Parliament, the King, the Pope, and all the powers of the world and of hell, in order that they might be punished. This is what popery calls religious fervor. This worthy monk had perhaps a little too much zeal. It might be hesitatingly admitted by the hypocrites of our days, whom Rome still makes much of as her most faithful adherents, but who give small evidence of Christianity. The king's lieutenant, who at that period represented the government, reminded them of the respect due to judicial forms, which must not be violated, even in the case of this heretic. Let him be put to death! Let him be put to death! Replied the people. To the fire with him! To the fire with him! Let him be burned! Exclaimed the clergy. The magistrate above named, not being able to appease the tumult, promised to go to Aix to refer the matter to the Parliament, analogous to the Cour Royale of the present time. The populace would have dispersed, but the monk prevented them, and the consuls of the city sanctioned this sort of municipal comitis with their presence. It was resolved that four persons should go to Aix at the expense of the commune, to accompany the procureur du roi, and urge the condemnation of Romier. These four deputies were the first consul, by name Cavallian, Judge Barbizi, the advocate general, and a registrar. But on the way they met one of the presidents of the court of Aix, named Ambroise, who said to them, You surely need not make so much ceremony about the burning of a heretic. The deputation made haste to return, that they might hurry on the sentence of death, and the king's lieutenant pursued his way alone. Having arrived at Aix, he laid the whole matter before the court, which called up the case before itself and interdicted the court of Draguignan from pronouncing sentence. But fanaticism does not so readily let go its hold. Barbizi set out again for Aix, and obtained a decree that sentence should be pronounced in the court of first resort. This was, in fact, to obtain the condemnation, or rather the judicial assassination and legal tortures of poor Romier. He was accordingly condemned to undergo, first the rack, then the wheel, then to be burned alive, and that by a slow fire. O justice! O charity! But did popery ever know you? Romier might still have escaped the infliction of this atrocious sentence at the expense of an abjuration. But the monk who was sent to make this proposal to him declared, as he came out from the prison, that he found him pertinax, and that he was a man already damned. The language of these men was as barbarous as their manners, as cruel as their doctrines. The priests were immediately requested to announce, in all the surrounding parishes, that on the 16th of the month of May would take place, in public, the execution of a frightful Lutheran, and in the town of Draguignan proclamation was made, by sound of trumpet, that every good Catholic should bring wood for the pile. The king's lieutenant, who had endeavored to save Romier from this unjust execution, withdrew from the town, that he might not be a witness of it. But his substitute, accompanied by a number of judges, both civil and ecclesiastical, as well as by the consuls of the town, repaired in the morning to the prison of the condemned man, in order to apply the torture. They displayed before him the rack, the cords, the wedges, the bars of iron, and in one word, all the instruments of torture invented by the successors of the martyred apostle. They said, Denounce your accomplices and abjure your errors, instead of exposing yourself to these torments. I have no accomplices, replied Romier. I have nothing to abjure, for I profess nothing but the law of Christ. You now call it perverse and erroneous, but at the day of judgment God will proclaim it just and holy, to the confusion of its transgressors. Whereupon, says Crespin, being placed upon the Gehenna and fearfully pulled by the cords, he cried without ceasing to God, that he would have pity upon him for the love of Jesus. Implore the Virgin now, said these idolaters. We have only one mediator, he replied. O Jesus! O my God! Grace! Grace! And he fainted. For upon his refusal the torture had been recommenced, says the chronicler, and that in so violent a manner that he was left for dead. Then the monks and the priests unloosed him from the wheel, fearing lest he should expire without being burned. The bones of his arms and legs were broken, and the points of the displaced parts of bones stuck out through the flesh. They gave him some cordials to recall him to life. He was then removed to the place of execution, and fastened by an iron chain to the stake, which rose from the center of the pile. Even now a monk addressed him, saying, "Call upon the Virgin and the saints!" The poor mercer of Villardiarnes made a sign with his head in the negative. Thereupon the executioners set fire to the pile. As it was composed, in great part, of branches and bushes, the flame at first rose with rapidity, then the half-burned fuel sank together, so that the martyr remained suspended to the stake above the devouring fire. His inferior members were shriveled, his entrails running out, and his poor body already half-burned below, when his lips were still seen to move, without any sound proceeding from them, but attesting the martyr's last invocation of the divine being his last appeal to that Christ who died for him. And doubtless that appeal was heard. And doubtless that vengeful prophecy shall be fulfilled, which for 18 centuries has been suspended over the head of the apocalyptic monster, whose sins have reached up unto heaven, and whose mouth has drunk, unto intoxication, the blood of saints and of martyrs. Yet we are told that we ought to employ, with regard to the papacy, that reserve and expression which is proper enough in the case of a wicked man for whose conversion we may hope, but not as to the inveterate wickedness of ages. The tree is to be judged by its fruits, and if the old trunk, which has served as a gibbet for so many victims, bears fruits less fatal in our day, it is because of its decrepitude, but restore its strength or trace it to the source of its bloody sap, and you will find it the same as ever. Let it be known, and it must be condemned. There were also 3 unfortunate persons who, in 1563, were left to die of hunger at Gabardres, in a deep pit, and 40 persons put to death by the sword, the rope, or the fire in the Valley of Apt, 46 at Lormoran, 17 at Merindol, and 22 in the Valley of Aix. All these crimes were perpetrated 15 years after the fearful massacres of which notice has been already taken. But to give an example of the arrogant opposition which the Inquisition sometimes made to the will of the sovereign, and even to the edicts which he had signed, disputing with him for its victims. After the articles agreed upon at Cavour in 1561, between Emmanuel Philibert and the Vaudois, they ought not to have been proceeded against in any way, for anything that had taken place during the War of 1560. However, a man belonging to St. John, Gaspar Orso by name, had been made prisoner at that time, and to save his life he promised to become a Catholic. But after the peace had been concluded, he returned to the sincere profession of his faith and religion. The inquisitors caused him to be watched by spies, and in 1570 he was seized, tied with cords, and conveyed to the prisons of the Holy Office at Turin. Against this the Vaudois reclaimed, on the ground of the amnesty which had been granted. The Duke ordained the inquisitors to release their prisoner, but they refused to obey. The Edict of Cavour was laid before them, which this detention contravened. "Our order is not subject to the secular power," replied the worthy Dominicans. They were very willing to take advantage of that power, but not to bow to it. Upon this, Philibert, irritated, informed them in reply that all the frocked legions upon earth would not make him break his word, and that they must forthwith captive free, if they did not wish cannon to be sent to bury them under the ruins of their den. On this unexpected language, the Holy Office found it necessary to yield. Orso was set free, and the Duke of Savoy wrote to the Vaudois on the 20th of November 1570, through the governor of the province, to reassure them that they need no longer entertain any fear regarding further proceedings based upon similar promises of abjuration. The firmness which he showed in this instance in compelling respect for the edict which he had issued is honorable to the character of the prince. But that edict itself had been obtained by the firmness which the Vaudois displayed in legitimate self-defense. The obstinacy of the holy office alone cannot be praised, for it was obstinacy in evil. Although it thus appears that the attempts of the papal party were not always successful, but that those escaped against whom they were directed, I think it right to quote some other examples of their evil doings, to give an idea of the dangers with which the Vaudois were perpetually surrounded. The reader will remember that when they were menaced in one valley by the princes and seigneurs who ruled in it, they often retired to another beyond the bounds of their authority, or more powerful to resist them. The pastor of Praviglelm, himself a native of Babi, had already found such a refuge in the valley of Lucerna in 1592. It was at the time when the Duke of Savoy had just seized upon the Marquisate of Silesia, and found his possession of it disputed by France. Some time after, beginning to think that he might be able to keep hold of his conquest, he began also to manifest a disposition to repress the reformed. The people of Praviglelm now received information that a project was on foot for seizing their pastor. They resolved to save him, and assembled for the purpose of opening a path for him through the snows towards St. Frower. But they were surprised by a company of soldiers belonging to the garrison of Revel, which seized the minister and bore him off a prisoner. This took place during the night of the 27th of February, 1597.